Hello and good afternoon if you are in the Europe zone. Good evening, good morning, wherever else that you are joining us from across the globe. My name is Nargis Farzad and today I am welcoming you in my capacity as the Honorary Secretary of British Institute of Persian Studies, an arm of the British Academy in the UK, very lovingly known as BIPS. دوستان و سروران عزیز هر کجای دنیا که هستید به این برنامه ما خوش آمدید. We are delighted to be able to welcome today for our second in the series of the BIPS Zoom talks to invite Dr. Richard McClary, who we are doubly delighted that he very recently joined the Governing Council of the British Institute of Persian Studies. Dr. McClary is based at University of York, and I really do not need to introduce him, as all of you who are joining us today should know a lot about him. His expertise on the art, really, art and culture of the Persianate world, but with a very particular focus on the architecture. Now, I am very conscious that we only have about half an hour today. We have a 20-minute lecture, so I am going to stop talking and really not take any of the precious times that you are here to listen to Dr. McClary. Richard, can I welcome you? How wonderful to be able to have you with the magic of online lectures. Where are you right now?
I'm finally back in my office. Well, thank you so much for that fulsome introduction. I hope I can do it justice. I'm going to try and keep it brief. I'm going to give you a quick sort of run through some of the main points from my new monograph on the medieval monuments of Central Asia, looking at Karakhanid architecture. So what I'll look at a couple of the earlier buildings from the Samanids, look at two particular Karakhanid sites, and then just quickly look at some of the later sort of Timurid style buildings to see where it fits into the long durée of development. It has to really stand in for Samanid architecture. We know so little about that, and it's incredibly influential in determining what Timurid architecture looks like, although there's a lot more glaze and scale in the latter example.
Wonderful. So I'm going to mute myself, and I will, of course, let our audience know about the housekeeping rules around questions. I'm sure you'll be inundated for questions. So wonderful. Here I am at your service if you need me, but the floor or the internet is yours, Richard.
Thank you, Nargis. Right, well, I'll start off with a map, just for those of you who don't have an intimate knowledge of the geography of Central Asia. I know there must be one or two of you out there. And this is just going to show you some of the buildings that we're going to look at and where they fit into the broader landscape. So the Karakhanids took over from the Samanids, who were the first Persian dynasty, and the Karakhanids were the first Turkic Muslim dynasty. The Oxus River was their boundary. They split the territories of the Samanids with the Ghaznavids to the south. And we're going to look at the mausoleum in Tim, which is just here between Bukhara and Samarkand, this building in Bukhara, and then this is the Shahizinde in Samarkand. And the two main Karakhanid monuments, and the focus today is on funerary monuments, is one that's just inside Kyrgyzstan at Safed Buland, in a very difficult to access place. I can see why it's not very well studied, having been there a couple of times. And then we're also going to look at a series of three monuments in near Osh, in a place called Uzgend, which was one of the Karakhanid capitals. They were constantly splitting. It was very much a sort of People's Republic of Judea, Judean People's Republic. And they kept constantly dividing. The only thing we really know about their dynasty is through the coins. The Russian scholar Bartolt really gave us the map and the understanding of what was done where through his study of the coinage. And it's been added to, but not really improved upon in the last century or more. This building, familiar to most of you, I'm sure, built in around 930, the Tomb of the Samanids, modeled arguably on the Chartak, the fire temple, but also referencing elements from earlier Sogdian architecture. and it's got the same decoration on all four sides. So whichever angle you come at it from, it looks the same. Inside, it has a couple of interesting features. This wide central rib is something very distinctive to Samanid architecture and continues on into a couple of later Karakhanid buildings, but doesn't really occur beyond them. We also have these columns with a sort of combination of a capital and a bracket, very typically Sogdian. No Sogdian buildings survive, but there are several pieces of metalwork that do depict a certain building style, and this is what we think that's from. And finally, if you look at these sort of pointed tip lunettes, these windows, if they were filled in, you'd think it was a Mokarno's cell, a structural Mokarno's cell, but with it being a window frame, in essence, it's really a proto-Mokarno's, but it seems to be under the Samanids that these tend to develop. The next building is the only other Samanid building that survives in any detail that has a lot of ornament, is this the Arabata tomb at Tim. It's halfway between Bukhara and Samarkand on the southern, more out of the way route. The motorway now runs further to the north. And this is the earliest dated example, not only of a building with a pishtak, a single monumental entrance, but the other three sides being entirely plain, as you can see in this view. But it also has the earliest dated Mokarno's that are structural, these ones here. So these do actually serve a structural purpose, corbelling out to transition from a square building to an octagonal zone that then creates a base upon which a circle for the base of the dome can be set. Now, looking at Karakhanid buildings, this is the earliest intact surviving structure, and it really is such a contrast because the exterior has an absolute honesty, purity to form. There's no ornamentation and there's no evidence of there ever having been any. In contrast, the interior in its original incarnation was incredibly richly decorated, high relief, low relief stucco, brightly painted. It was like a jewel box. I'm generally using older images because there's a rather ugly but essential steel armature both inside and outside the building, which was added by the Soviets in the 70s because the structure is at risk of collapse. So this is one of Cohn-Wiener's photographs, and this is a drawing modified by me, but mostly done by an unnamed Soviet era artist in the early 1920s. Inside, like I say, there's a lot of decoration. The dado section has this low relief incised patterns with a triple, like an escutcheon arch, as it could be called, and these Celtic knot-like patterns for those who are familiar with more European art. But there's a different type of ornament on other walls, and this is up to about waist height, about one meter high. If I go back, as you can see, one of these rather wonderful steel armature pieces that's in place. As you move up inside the building, the ornament increases, the level of ornamentation, the richness, the scale of the inscriptions, and generally the overwhelming power of the carving art of the stucco craftsmen. This area is viewed very much now as a periphery of the Islamic world and a peripheral area, but at the time it was built, it was very much a central place. The Fargana Valley, it's at the east end of the Fargana Valley. It's very close to one of the Karakhanid capitals. And it was the main nexus point whereby goods coming from China entered the Islamic world and moved to the west. So it's not something that should be viewed as a remote, out of the way place in the way that it might be considered now. There's a series of roundels on the wall, and there you can see, if we compare the micro on the right and the macro on the left, you have the same sort of format used in a monumental scale using the same inscription, this is Quran 933 in this case, around the edge, but one is immobile and demonstrates the power of the ruler in situ on a large scale, and the other bears the name of the ruler and is disseminated on a small, yet still valuable, it's still in silver. So it allows for the power projection on two different ends of the scale. Here you can see the context of it. There's another inscription band of which there's just one tiny fragment remaining here, a little bit more on another wall. But you can see there's a, you know, if ever there was a justification for this rather outdated horror vacuee, you can see it here. There's really very limited area that isn't ornamented. It's in total contrast to the exterior of the building. This is the only surviving readable section of that Dado inscription, and it has a very exaggerated letter form. So quite unusual, the ha form here and the ya is quite distinctive, and these very, very wide, broad hastai tips, far beyond what a kalem reed would widen to as you push it on the page, which is what is being imitated by that. And then incredibly slender shaft. So there's a swelling and an exaggeration of the letter forms here. And we'll see that in a later cursive inscription from the following century in Uzgen a little bit later on. This is a combination of two different people's work, so I claim no authorship of it, but it's an attempt to demonstrate how brightly colored the interior of this building was. There's a lot of traces of green, yellow, red, blue, and black remaining in the building, although they're very faint now, and the entire ceiling decoration is completely lost, even in the early 20th century. But one can imagine the contrast of going into what looks like an entirely austere buff brick building and being hit by this panoply of colors and texture all over every surface inside. The upper inscriptions, one is slightly lower relief, now completely lost, although it was recorded, photographed by Kernvina, and then transcribed and translated by Nastic more recently. But the one at the top of the square section, this one at the top is in the octagonal section, but the one at the top of the square section of the building is perhaps the most distinctive and certainly unique. It's always dangerous using the term unique referring to Karakhanid architecture, because so little survives that there may have been quite a lot of them, but there's so little building survive. But this is very unique and not seen in any other regions. And what's happened is the inscription is carved in fairly low relief with vegetal decoration around it, and then added on, like as if it's been squeezed out of a tube of toothpaste or a French baguette cut in half, are the letter forms giving high relief without having to cut a lot of material away. And they're attached with dowels. And you can see here, there's just little points of where these dowels were. So it's a very innovative, unusual, and distinctive style of inscription that we see here. And this is also the important thing with this building, it's the first building that's datable through the rulers. We know when they ruled from 1055, that it's the earliest example of Persian being used in the context of architecture. It's possible that the Samanids did, but there's none surviving. But the first verifiable example is the three of the inscription bands in this building. And for the most part, when the Karakhanids use Persian, they use a more cursive script. And when they're using Arabic, they'll use a more Kufic script. Not an absolute rule. There's no such thing as absolute rules with any of these medieval things, but a general trend. Now, if we look at the next site, this spans the period from before the Shah Fazl right through to almost the end of the Karakhanid period. So the central building, or what is original of it, dates from the early 11th century, and then the other two buildings are for the middle and near the end of the 12th century. As we'll see, the central building is mostly rebuilt, but there is some original elements. This drawing in the middle shows just how much had been lost prior to it being rebuilt in the 1960s. And the panel on the left, it was a very small black and white photograph of this panel in a book by Ernest Knobloch that drew me into Karakhanid architecture. I was just finishing my PhD on Rum Seljuk architecture way over to the west in Anatolia, trying to understand the origins of this geometric strapwork, where it came from, how it came to be in Anatolia. And this small photograph made me think, maybe I can persuade the university to pay me for me to go to Kyrgyzstan and have a look at this. And they foolishly did, and that's what led to me spending the last 5 years working on these monuments. So it's always always worth taking note of those small photographs. But this is the only original section of the main decoration of the facade, as well as a tiny bit of the inscription band, too small to read, but interesting enough to see the letter forms and some of the elements of the decoration. In its original incarnation, the building had two portal. So it's a two Pishtak building. So although it's built after both of the Samanid buildings, both the one in Bukhara and the one in Tim, it fits between the two in terms of development and just speaks to the innovative syncretic nature of Karakhanid architecture. So on the one hand, if you view it from one corner, it would look like a copy of the building in Bukhara, the tomb of the Samanids. But if you look at it from the other corner, it would look like it only has one portal and is referencing Tim. There's not really any other buildings that follow this pattern. The other portal is now hidden behind a later structure, but little sections were revealed during the rebuilding and restoration when Gorbachev was working on it from the 60s into the 70s. So they did do some documentation, and I managed to recreate roughly how the portal would have appeared in terms of plan and elevation, we'll see later. And it's not identical. So we see here there is a small cavetto on this facade, but there isn't on the surviving west-facing one. Again, I'm no draftsman. This was the best sort of I could come up with my inability to use proper drawing skills, but it does serve the purpose to show how, from this perspective, it looks very similar to the building in Bukhara, but then I'd say it's only on the two sides that you see this. To the left, about 150 meters from this view, there is a surviving short minaret from the period and the excavated remains that have been filled in of a large mosque. So in terms of its urban context, it's near the main mosque of the city with its minaret. There's also been some argument and minor excavational evidence that there were other tombs around it, but not enough is known if they were there as a result of this being here or there originally. It's hard to say. Inside, some of the original decoration does survive, and although it's fragmentary, it's not enough to read anything. There's no literary or textual content. There's enough to see that even in these small fragments that survive, there's three very different types of inscription, very unique letter forms, some of which still under development. This one in particular is very distinctive, not really seen anywhere else. Quite simply carved, all done in stucco, and you can imagine once the roof collapses and there's not going to be a great deal of resistance to rain, and it's this section here under the arch in the corner that does reveal this part here that's the best preserved. Early use of Mukarnas, again following on, a little bit more decorative here, they're not really structural because it's the bricks that hold it up. There's also internal woodwork, and you can see that there's a narrower but still widish central rib pronounced, very distinctive to the region and not seen beyond. Added on, so I'm running low on time, but a few more to look at. Added on afterwards was the Jalal ad-Din Hussein tomb, built in the middle of the 12th century. And this is distinctively very much diminutive. There's a clear reference down in scale, an honorific to get the barakat of the tomb to which it's attached. It has this intrados of the arch. That's a very common motif for the region, the eight-pointed star and the pointed tip cross, usually seen in tiles or terracotta mouldings. But in this case, because it's carved in stucco, the artist allows the motif to go under and over and give it a far greater sense of depth, although you do see the odd mistake here, but that's the nature of innovation, mistakes are made. Here's the face of it, and in another Persian inscription with a rather swelling, fattened letter forms. We'll see more of that in the later tomb, as well as stucco decoration in the tympanum. And again, we see cursive for the Persian and a very mechanical Kufic inscription running along just below. Here's a color version, a little larger to see just how mechanical the hastai tips are, almost separated or entirely separated in some cases from the text. The third tomb that's added on is added in 1186. And this just demonstrates why these historical photos are so important in order to understand what is authentic and what is about the same age as my grandmother. A lot of decoration here, all done in terracotta now. There's no stucco. And interestingly, for a late building, no glaze. A contemporaneous minaret built in Vabkent around the same time does start to see a lot of turquoise glaze being used, but for whatever reason, there isn't any on this building. The Kufic is a bit more flowing with these knotting, being a lot more curvilinear, and a little incised line just around the edge. Doesn't seem that important, but it just adds a little bit of relief and depth and dynamism to the letter forms. And this capital is very distinctive of Karakhanid architecture. I use the term vase capital or vase capital, but it could be called a lyre. Others have used the term campaniform. I think Professor Hillenbrand's the one who's done that the most, because it looks like an upturned bell. And you have this collar with a similar mechanical kufic, and there is an inscription just below. And it also manages to create this same 8-point star and pointed tip cross pattern. So there's a dialogue and a sort of sense of unity across the whole building, across different media and scale. The little tympanum has these square sections added almost like tiles, but they're unglazed. And then this inscription is really very distinctive, much fatter, swollen letters, and a sort of lam aleph, fictive lam aleph form inserted instead of the knotted vertical form seen in the kufic. It's a little bit more dynamic. And if we look at something, again, going back to this micro-macro discussion, you see it on the building here with the leaves in the background and the letters with these swollen tips and ends. And the only real comparative that I've been able to find is on a Ghurid Quran dated 1177, so relatively contemporaneous. It's now in the Topkapi Museum. We don't know where that was made, but it is inscribed to a Ghurid ruler. But it even has the same vegetal form as well as these swellings. So we've seen a couple of examples of Karakhanid architecture, but where does it lead to? Where is it going? And the Shah-i Zindeh, or the Living King, is a series of tombs built on the hill that runs down from Afrasiab, or the old Samarkand, down to the edge of the new Samarkand, near the main sites of major Timurid construction. But it was already existing as a main thoroughfare in the Karakhanid period. So this building here would be just here. These are only Karakhanid sites on here. All that survives is the stub of the little minaret encased in a later building. But Nina Nepetse, they excavated the site for years and years throughout the second half of the 20th century. And a large madrasa was found along with the foundations of various different mausolea. This one here, one of the latest ones, that's the foundation of it, just there if you can see the person. And what happens is you see the same form. The building form doesn't change, but the appearance is radically different. So you still see the same engaged capitals, intrados, tympanum, cursive inscriptions, but all done in polychrome glaze rather than monochrome terracotta. But the form, the genesis, is clearly coming from the earlier. Some of these are technically by the date Chagatai. They're not actually Timurid, but they do carry on into it. And of course, craftsmen don't change their working methods just because there's a new broom sweeping into the local palace. But there is a monumentalizing trend as the Timurids really start to rise in power. Now you see the same capital form, the same collar with inscriptions, also running around the sort of inscription around the frame. But again, deeper relief and use of colour. And a lot of the other decorative elements can be seen to have carried on and just been converted into glaze. So here on the left are some of the things from these tombs just south of the madrasa, datable to the 12th century. Fragmentary and reconstructed, but clearly the same pattern in the same sort of context on the facade of a tomb. And even again, this something akin to the escutcheon arch is also seen here. And you'll see, although a lot of these tiles are from the 14th century, quite a lot are also from the 20th century. But when you see how many tiles from this site are spread around various museums in the UK, North America, across Europe, it's no wonder there are quite a lot of gaps to fill in. On that note, I think I'll wrap up. I haven't gone too far over, and happy to take any questions if anyone has any.
Absolutely delightful. Why on earth did we just give you 20 minutes? I could have listened for 2 hours. Absolutely splendid, Richard. And I can give goodness, Ferron, as you say, so remote for us now, but we can understand why Rumi said, you know, Nimi ze Turkestan, Nimi ze Ferron. It was absolutely the center of it all. So Richard, already we have the question. So if I invite you, our lovely audience, that we've decided that, you know, one question per person. So kindly type your questions in. And Richard, we have one, the first question is already, that after gratitude for this amazing talk, could you repeat the name of the first Qarahani tomb you mentioned, the one with the medallions near the top? Perhaps you can even go back.
The Shah Fazl tomb.
Shah Fazl tomb.
Shah Fazl, and it's in Safed Buland, or Safed Buland.
Oh, Safed Buland. Very good, very good. And can I invite more questions, please? So how easy, so while we wait for the questions to come, Richard, how easy is it to access these sites?
In terms of visa and bureaucracy, far easier than it ever has been in the last sort of since the Mongols, really.
Oh, wow, goodness.
So, you know, a lot of them now, you don't need a visa to go to Uzbekistan. Okay. The last time I went, I didn't believe it. I thought I was going to get sort of harangued at the airport, but yeah. They're more than happy to let you in. Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, the same. So in terms of politics, very easy. With one change of flight in Istanbul, Turkish Airlines fly to everyone. I mean, you can fly to Osh, you can fly to places like Ganja in Azerbaijan.
Yes.
In that way, very easy. Once you're in country, though, the Shah Fazl in particular is very difficult to get to, just because you have to drive for a day in the middle of nowhere. I arrived in a shared taxi in what I read in the only guidebook said there might be a hotel, there was an in-tourist one. Turns out there wasn't a hotel as it was getting dark, but a very kind family took pity on me and put me up.
So that
makes it a bit more difficult. And then it's actually another half a day drive from there. Luckily, the grandfather wanted to go see his sister, who is in Safed Buland. So all the roads that used to go from Kervan to Safed Buland all used to run through into what is now part of Uzbekistan.
Yes.
So now they had to cut a new road around this sort of Stalin era arbitrary border. So that one is a little bit more challenging, but for the most part, certainly the ones in the cities, they're very easy to get to. And book plug alert, there's a gazetteer in the back, so it tells you how to get to all of them.
I wonder, and they're not fenced off. I mean, you can actually walk up or enter, so as you have done, those photographs, amazing. And the next question is, what about the tomb of the Qarahanids in Taraz or Zambil? Not much ancient, but a bit.
Yes, so there's the tomb of the Qarahanids in Taraz was photographed in the late 19th century, but the vast majority of Qarahanid architecture, and indeed later, was destroyed by the Soviets. They picked certain monuments to strip of any religious context and view them as monuments to the workers that built them and sort of cultural entities and cultural structures, and sort of sanitized them of any religious context, preserved them as museums, often rebuilt and restored them. But thousands and thousands of other funerary sites, shrines, were completely destroyed, and that was one of them. So the building that's there now was built, I think, in the 1960s. So there is the there is a tomb just outside Taraz, but the Aisha Bibi tomb.
Yes, I've heard
that. About one of the four walls survived, and now the other three have been rebuilt in the roof. But there is a core section of that which is original. But no, most of what's interesting about Taraz is the museum holding fragments of these buildings from excavations. And there's also an excavation ongoing that UCL have been involved with in the center of the city, in the market, that's found some interesting bathhouses. So much of what we know about the Qarahanids is architectural, I mean, archaeological.
Okay, for that. So we have the third question after, again, very many thanks for this wonderful lecture. I'm wondering how the Rabat Malik Karavansaray's facade built under the Qarahanids fits into the context of these Qarahanid buildings you showed.
So it's quite interesting. It was photographed in the 1920s, and it had a series of ribs, or corrugations is another term. So it had one of the two big corner towers, would be called a minaret normally, but it is just a tower. So it was part of a much larger facade, very similar to this excavated remains of the madrasa in the Shah Zindis. So but there are comparable structures that it fits into. It also has a cursive Persian inscription on the face of the arch. So again, it's slightly later than the ones that we saw in the Shah Fazl, but it does fit into that same thing, larger in scale, of course, with it being, I mean, whether it is really a rabat, whether it's a caravanserai, a lot of these buildings were multifunctional in the same way that even today rooms are multifunctional. It's a living room in the day and a bedroom at night. It can function as a caravanserai until the royal court are moving through, then it becomes a royal palace for a short period, and then continues on as a caravanserai when they leave. So they do change function. But yeah, it certainly does fit into it. And the photographs, the earlier photographs show a lot more decoration. And the same, or this idea of it having this ribbing fits in with earlier buildings in Merv, and a sort of little motif that's seen on one of the buildings in Bukhara.
Yes, well, wonderful. That was lovely to see. That was from our colleague, Dr. Sarkozy. I wonder where you are. You normally, we get messages from you from Iran. So let us know, Miklos. So fantastic. And then the next question, what is the calculation system, mathematical system that has been used for design and constructing the ornaments you have shown? And okay, perhaps you do that and then I'll read the other questions. Yeah.
Well, Bulatov, the Soviet scholar, did a mind-numbingly deep mathematical study of all of the Central Asian material, but I'm somewhat skeptical. A lot of it was the political context, but it needed to have a mathematical, rational basis rather than any sort of spiritual or religious. And just the working methods of craftsmen were generally far more practical. If you've got a piece of string and a stylus, you can design incredibly complex, seemingly complex designs from very simple modular units being built up and expanded. So I'm not convinced with a lot of this taking of drawings of a building and starting to draw arcs and curves and put sine pi r over 3 and tell me that that's how it was designed. There is a rationality and a proportional element to it, but a lot of it is being built to suit the lot that's available. You can't just expropriate land into the system, under the Raksh system. You take what you can get. You can't, even rulers generally can't knock buildings down. So you make it fit the plot, and then within that, you make it proportionally rational within that.
Fantastic. A question from Masoud Khan. What period does the, probably not pronouncing this right, Balsagon Tower in northeastern Kyrgyzstan belong to?
It appears to be quite early. There's in the Chu Valley, there's a couple of cities, and Akbeshim is thought to have been an earlier site where the Karakhanids were. There's been excavations there that show a minaret base and coin finds that generally give the date. And there is some indication that then Balasagun then becomes a capital after that. So probably early 11th century.
Oh, wow, that makes sense, thank you. And a question from another member of Friends of PIPS and Iranian Studies, Armin Yavari. Greetings, Richard. Excellent talk, which of course we all concur. Has a list been compiled of the buildings defaced and or destroyed by the Soviets that general public could access?
The problem is that so much of it was unrecorded prior to destruction. So it really isn't possible. And most of what was destroyed was either shrine sites in remote areas that people don't know they were there, or urban sites that were then built upon. So it needs to be, it's really what we're tending to find out now, that the Kazakhs in particular, Kazakhstan's doing a lot of excavating to try and understand what there was in their territories, and new cities are being found. So it's possible to discover other pieces of evidence to understand that the style of building and the form and the types of building. But in terms of what was destroyed, there's no records. They weren't keeping a record of the destruction. It was just fairly haphazard, and it was It was one of those things, if you were seen to be pro-preservation and various different times under Stalin, it could end, you could end up in the gulag. So it was very much the done thing to not be pro-preservation, which meant obviously the done thing is then to be destructive, but that's not something that was recorded. So there are publications from the early 1920s, before this period came in, of preservation and conservation practices, but it then shifts after that. So in the early period, they're using authentic materials and techniques. In the later period, they tended to use steel reinforced concrete and modern tiles. And it wasn't, they didn't know how to, but it was a political agenda to show that they were doing it the most modern way, in the way they were built in the most modern way at the time.
Absolutely. Well, a question from one of our guests who is watching this on Facebook. Again, very many thanks for this informative presentation. Can you please talk about the other places of worship, churches there from 11th to 14th century, please?
There's very little known about the Buddhist structures and the Christian churches from that period. There's not even really any mosques that survive. There's one, the Diggeron, which may be Simonid, maybe early Karakonid, and there's the facade of the Magoki Atori Mosque in Bukhara. But there's surprisingly limited religious structures. You know, there are quasi-religious structures like madrasas, tombs obviously have a religious element in terms of the inscription, but there's so little survives. You know, it tends to be things like minarets, which paradoxically survive earthquakes better than anything else because they can dissipate energy as they sway. They might lose the top bit, but they don't just pancake down like other buildings. But no, there are lots of kairaks, or these sort of grey round river stones that are used as grave markers both by Muslims and Christians. So they do survive. So there is evidence of the Christian population. And in the later period, there's accounts of them from the Mongol period. But in terms of standing churches, there's nothing at all, certainly that I'm aware of, and even excavations. There's a couple of sites that have been thought to be Buddhist temples, but again, very hard to be certain about.
Presence of Zoroastrian places of worship, do you think?
It's a bit further north.
The problems
with the Bukhara tomb being sort of seen as a Chagatai attack is that it would be, even that is an imported form, if you're talking north of the Oxus.
Yes, amazing. So while I'm sure there'll be a couple of more questions, I know I'm going to be very Iranian and pay no attention to the finishing time. So we might have a couple of more minutes. Of course, I might get told off by Kendall. But tell us, Richard, what next? Tell us about the projects that you're working on now. Field studies that, of course, you know, once the new normal settles in.
Taking a gamble, I'm off to do some work in central Anatolia in a couple of weeks. I figure if people can go on holiday to Turkey, then I can go and do some field work there. So, I'm working on a book on the Konya Kiosk, which I'm writing with Patricia Blessing, who's just started at she started at Princeton. So I'm doing that with her. I'm doing a very big edited volume on early Islamic stucco, which has got 18 different contributors from Spain through to India and Central Asia. And my main project that I'm sort of coming to an end with, it's not coming to an end, but it's coming along well, is a monograph on Minai ware, which is my other sort of passion. So that will be hopefully be coming out with Brill, as long as the peer reviewers are happy.
Yes. So before we wrap up, I know that you also have been thinking about a series of talks very much in memorial to our mutual friend, Bruce Wanold, who is absolutely very, very sorely missed, who passed away in January. Can you just tell us about those talks, when they might commence?
Yes, so it's an annual event that'll be around Nowruz which is just around the time that he died, and was is a lovely time to remember him and to bring old friends and new together. So the plan is that it'll be held in York around Nowruz every year. We've had a lot of very generous contributions from people to help support it. If anyone else is interested, you can get in touch with me. It'll be the funds will be held in by BIPs. It's being run in conjunction with BIPs. But yes, as he was a scholar of great range and interest, we're going to try and bring a big range of different people. And sometimes it might not be a lecture, it might be a concert.
But that is the best way, isn't it? Amazing, Richard. You know, I can't thank you enough. It's such a busy time in university time in August. So it's been an absolute pleasure, privilege and delight to have you and your amazing pictures. And thank you to all our audience from across the globe. And before we bid you farewell, I want you to please check the website of University of York to follow more on Richard's activities. And of course, BIPs, please don't forget, Rafiq Nimera Naboshid, definitely stay with us. And our next talk, which is by Dr. Shabnam Holiday, a lecture on Iran in global international relations context, the importance of area studies. And that lecture on Zoom is scheduled for again at 4 p.m. on the 9th of September. But do please check our website, and we look very much forward to having you back. Please stay safe. هر جا که هستید شاد و سلامت و تندرست و گل و بلبل باشید. Well, thank you again very much. واقعا سپاسگزاریم Richard John. It's been really lovely, and we look forward to having you back soon. فعلا خداحافظ. خدا نگهدار.